From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Tim Fleming.
You are swimming through water that is so clear that you can see penguins jumping in toward the end of the swim and swimming with you. You can see them porpoising through the water and see their water bubbles coming up all around you. And you are sort of in a world that nobody else has really been in this way before.
The woman tough enough to swim the first Antarctic mile. We'll hear from her later on. Today, we'll meet strong women around the world. Stunt women who kick butt in the movies, and women who find their inner strength after the horrors of war.
To see that the resilience in human spirits, to see the courage they have to say, I'm not giving up, I am going to continue going, and that's how I fight the enemy, by surviving, by keep on going, by building my country, by building my life.
Also, why women in the workplace are struggling to make sense of their problems after the feminist revolution.
Their instinct was to question what they were doing wrong or how they were failing instead of looking at their problems in a more collective manner.
Shows like Wonder Woman paved the way for the tough women in today's action movies, like Kill Bill and Charlie's Angels. Of course, the truth is, even Hollywood stars need help. That's where stunt doubles come in. Amanda McKayle follows two high-profile women stunt doubles, Jeannie Epper and Zoe Bell, in her new documentary, Double Dare. McKayle told Anstrengchamps that women stunt doubles appear all the time in movies, and not always where you'd expect.
Anytime you see an actress tripping over a vacuum cleaner, that's a stunt woman. If there's a prostitute getting thrown down a flight of stairs, which happens more than you would think, I've watched a lot of movies looking for stunts, and, you know, that's a stunt woman. So it's not just the big hero moments. There's a lot of little moments, a lot of victim moments that stunt women are always there for. And I think, you know, you talk to any stunt woman, and they'll say, oh, yeah, I've gone down the stairs in a little nighty or lingerie. And, you know, that was one of the things that became very apparent to me was that costuming was a big issue for these women in their jobs. I mean, you look at the roles in Hollywood movies, and usually women are scantily clad. So if you have a stunt woman doing a big stunt, she's usually getting hit by a car in a miniskirt or high heels or something like that, whereas her male counterpart gets to wear a three-piece suit or you know, sweatpants and a baggy shirt, so he can hide pads under there.
When I was doing Wonder Woman, you couldn't wear any stunt padding at all. But they did let us wear nylons. We got to wear supportos. Luckily, the second season, we had flat boots. The first year, we did not have flat boots. They made us boots that were like wedgie heels. I used to tape my ankles almost like a football player. We just put on what they give you and do it.
Now, that's the voice of Jeannie Epper, and she's one of these two amazing stunt women you profile in your movie. Tell me something about Jeannie.
Yeah, Jeannie was the first woman that I met after I was pitched this idea, and I just fell in love with her. She was the president of the Stunt Women's Association. She is definitely sort of the grand dame of the stunt world, not just for women, but for men, too.
People constantly ask me, God, aren't you getting about ready to retire? You know, nobody else lives in my body. They don't know how I really feel. I feel great. And as long as I'm feeling good, why shouldn't I be out there working?
She was a double for Wonder Woman. She did all the stunts in Romancing the Stone for Kathleen Turner, that big stunt where she slides down the mudslide and swings across a ravine. And she's just done a million movies.
She's been doing stunts for something like 50 years, right?
Yeah, she's almost five decades. She started when she was just a little thing, you know, doubling. They used to use kids. I mean, they used to use midgets to double for kids. And so Jeannie was one of the first kids that they actually used to, you know, on horseback to double child actors.
How did she get into this in the first place?
Jeannie's dad was a very famous stuntman. He had doubled for Ronald Reagan and John Wayne and all kinds of guys in the Westerns. So she was born into it. I mean, her family was a stunt family. And, you know, Steven Spielberg says in Double Dare that they're the flying Walendas of film. And it's true. I mean, they're like a circus family, but they were in stunts. So she just was born into it.
Well, tell me something about what makes a stunt woman an incredibly good stunt woman? Like, what can Jeannie Epper do?
You know, it's interesting. I think a lot of stunt people have different talents. Jeannie was never really fond of high work, for example. That wasn't one of her specialties, but she had to really learn how to do it for Wonder Woman because all those jumps where Wonder Woman jumps up onto these buildings, and now, of course, it looks sort of hackneyed in retrospect. But those were pretty high falls because actually what they did was run them backwards. So she would be standing on top of a building and stepping backwards off of a tall building and then landing in an airbag. So I think, you know, for Jeannie, she has a fearlessness that she's willing to learn something even if it's not her specialty.
So Jeannie's what, in her 60s now, right?
Yeah, she's
and she's still doing stunts?
Yep.
What does she do now?
Well, you know, I mean, it's there's not big jobs for her anymore. I mean, sometimes she'll get something like, you know, being a granny that's about to get hit by a car or something. So sometimes it's really sort of slapstick comedic stuff. Other times she'll be coming in to double an actress that she's been doing work with for a long time who just feels comfortable with her.
I've been doing stunts for almost 50 years.
Whoa, guys, be careful.
It's all I really know outside of being a mom and a grandma. Retirement's not for me.
And roll it!
Now, Zoe Bell is the other stunt woman you profiled, and she's, I guess, what you could call part of the new generation of stunt women just coming up. She started her career on the cult TV show Xena the Warrior Princess, and I want to play a little clip from the show.
Hercules! Excuse me, we're conducting business here.
Hercules, you gotta go to Elysia.
What's wrong?
Invaders, led by a warrior called Darphus.
Darphus?
Can't be, he's dead.
By your hand, if you're Xena, he showed me a scar.
What scar?
A huge gaping hole right in the middle of his chest. He should have been dead.
Only the gods have the power to bring Darphus back from the dead. I can bet which one it is.
That means nothing to me. I'm still going to Elysia to stop Darphus. I won't fail this time.
That's a scene from Xena the Warrior Princess, one of the shows that Zoe was a stuntwoman on. What's Zoe like?
She's from New Zealand, and she's just sort of a rough and tumble girl who grew up on an island outside of Auckland. First of all, I mean, she's just like a nature girl. I think she has an attitude, again, a sort of fearlessness that she can learn almost anything. But certainly, her experience on Xena leaned towards martial arts and wire work. I mean, that is a big...
What's wire work?
Wire work is when you're wearing a harness, and you know that a lot of the Crouching Tiger stuff or the sort of martial artsy stuff that you've seen, and you know that's become more popular in American films in the last 5-10 years, is wire work. So the flips and the kicks and everything is all aided by wires. They don't want you to know that. That's true. But yeah, so Xena, there was a lot of wire work in Xena, and it takes a lot of gymnastic ability. Zoe's background was in gymnastics and martial arts, so she was, you know, from the age of, I don't know, 5 to 15, she probably was doing amateur but very serious gymnastics, and she ended up retiring and taking up martial arts. So that stuff really helped her with Xena.
Watching your film, the stunt women make it all look so easy. But there's one scene in your film where it really hit me, at least as a viewer, how terrifying a lot of this is, and that's the scene when Zoe, for the first time, does a high jump. Do you want to describe that?
Yeah, and I'm terrified of heights, so that was particularly... challenging for me. Zoe was going to do a high fall training with Jeannie when she first came to the United States. And, you know, they kept asking her, well, how high have you gone? She's like, I don't know. I don't know. I think I've, you know, done 20 or 30 feet. And 30 feet when you're standing on a high fall platform, which is about the size of a piece of bread, is pretty high. But I think the first fall that she did, they put her up to like 50 or 60 feet. And from up there, Zoe says, when you look down, your feet are bigger than everything that you're about to land on. You know, the thing you're going to land on looks like about the size of a postage stamp. You can tell Zoe's nervous. I mean, her heart was pounding, but she just pulled it off. And, you know, I think there's a lot of body awareness that she has that most of us don't have. So, of course, it looks easy.
I could do flips in a harness with my eyes closed and totally know where I am.
I'm tuning this way.
Oh, that way.
But when you start adding any complications, you have to understand how the rigs work and what the angles mean. Because it looks easy, people assume it is easy.
It's not just about having the guts to do it, and by no means are these women daredevils. I mean, they're very sort of exacting and precise when they're thinking about how they're moving and landing. It's not like, whee! So even though it looks like that from us, it's actually, you know, it's a sort of a precise thing that they're doing up there.
What's the most amazing thing you saw any of these women do?
I think when she the fire stunt where she gets lit, she's wearing a big red kimono and gets lit on fire. That impressed me, and it wasn't so much like, oh my god, she's getting lit on fire, but it was, oh my god, we've been here for 15 hours and she's been lit on fire 15 times, and just the repetitiveness of it, and just the stamina that it takes to be in 10 layers of long johns all night being lit on fire and covered with goop and, you know, whatever they're putting her out with and whatever they're lighting her up with. She was just covered with all different kinds of fuels and, you know, flame retardants, and it was really hot, and, you know, it was a long day. So it wasn't so much, again, the sort of impressiveness of one particular stunt than just sort of the dedication that it takes to get a shot like that finished, you know, just do it, do it, do it.
Now, I thought one of the most riveting scenes in the movie is the part where Zoe gets to audition at Quentin Tarantino's private training center, and there are all these other women there who are working with coaches, and Tarantino's just off to the side, and he's watching everything, and you know that Zoe's career is at the make-or-break point. Will you tell us about that part?
That actually is my favorite part of the movie, is watching Zoe audition and just the tension, because she kind of screws it up. She kind of falls on her face over and over and over again doing these flips, and we're all like, oh my god, I don't know if she's gonna get it. And she, you know, ends up getting the job and goes to Beijing, and we follow her there through Kill Bill. She proved in the audition that she was tough. You know, like I said, she lands on her face more than once. And I think Tarantino just was impressed by her gumption and just fell in love with her.
Amanda McKaylee is the director of the documentary Double Dare. She spoke with N. Strange Champs. While women stunt doubles struggle for equal recognition in Hollywood, women in the workplace across America are facing challenges of their own. But instead of rallying together for a new women's revolution, working women blame their woes on themselves. At least that's what Leah Macko says in her new book called Midlife Crisis at 30, How the Stakes Have Changed for a New Generation, and What to Do About It. Macko says she and co-worker Carrie Rubin faced the same truths at the same time.
We were working together at CNN on the launch of a new show right after 9/11, which, you know, living in New York, obviously, was a very reflective time period. Even though our lives and our career trajectories were very different, we both felt a sense of narrowing in our own lives, and we felt a sense of being trapped in a sort of one-dimensional environment, very different than what we intended to be thriving in. And, you know, we really were kind of shocked when we sat down and looked at the ways our professional lives were eclipsing our personal lives very unintentionally. So we started to talk to other women, and we very quickly recognized that many of them felt the same. And then we started conducting some research, and we realized pretty quickly there were some dots to be connected that were really telling a new story of our generation.
I'm curious, I guess, about some of the details about the two of you to get a sense of what you were doing. You were, I assume, both right around 30?
Correct. We were both 30. Actually, our birthdays are a month apart. Carrie had worked at CNN for many years as a producer. You know, she was recently married and was contemplating starting a family and was wondering how a child would fit into her professional equation. You know, and at that point, I had been a very single-minded, career-focused single woman living in New York. You know, our lives and our questions we were confronting were somewhat different, but our sensibility and our observations about the way we were feeling were very similar.
This was supposed to be a problem that was solved by the generations that came before you. The women in the 1960s and 70s had broken all the ground, and you were not supposed to have to face this, or at least that was the way it was set up. Clearly, that is less than an accurate view of reality, but I suppose it must have been something of a shock to realize it.
Well, I think that the women who came before us confronted so much, and their issues were very different, and we owe them such a debt of gratitude. You know, we write this book with the word crisis in the title with the full recognition that we're the luckiest generation of women to ever walk the planet, and the women who came before us are, you know, those we have to thank for the opportunities we've inherited. But what we're dealing with are new problems, new collective problems, Yet we are very reluctant as a generation to see them that way. You know, we were raised with such an independent mindset, and, you know, we were so self-reliant. We've been thriving in meritocracies since we were president of the student council and captain of our soccer teams. When we start to confront some remnants of a glass ceiling, usually not until our 30s, when we're, you know, really ready for that next big promotion, or until some women are trying to combine work and family in a meaningful way, we are very, very unlikely as a generation to internalize any of this as something that may be, you know, a lingering social problem or a lingering shortcoming in a corporate or political system. What we really do as a generation is we blame ourselves. And that's what we saw with all of these wonderful women we interviewed, that really, irrespective of their impressive life resumes, their instinct was to question what they were doing wrong or how they were failing instead of looking at their problems in a more collective manner.
I'm curious, you know, you call your book Midlife Crisis at 30. What is it about 30? Why is 30 such a difficult year?
Well, that's an excellent question. And really, 30 is, it's quantifiable why 30 is a number of significance for women right now. You know, if you look at what's happened with women in the last 30 years, tremendous changes. And basically, timetables for the way we order our lives have been inverted. You know, 30 years ago, women were marrying at age 22 on average. And today, college-educated women are marrying, you know, many times at 28 or closer to 30. Also, 30 years ago, many women were having their first child before their 30th birthday. Those same women now, many are waiting until after their 30th birthday. And most significantly, the number of single women between the ages of 30 and 34 has tripled over the course of just one generation. So what you're dealing with is an entirely new set of circumstances for women in a very, very short period of time, and very important decisions about career, motherhood, earning potential made on a very, very compressed timetable right around 30.
You know, there's another interesting aspect to this. Not long ago, there was a New York Times Magazine cover story called The Opt-Out Revolution. Did you see that?
Of course. Well, I'm so happy that you asked about that, because I found that article to be somewhat disturbing in the sense that it left you with the feeling that women have said or could say, you know, now we have it all. We decided we don't want it. We really want to be at home in our designer sweatsuits drinking our Starbucks coffee. And that is really not the story we're hearing. You know, of the over 100 women between the ages of 25 and 37 we interviewed for this book, not one of them said, oh, I have this biological pull. I feel like I need to be home. I need to be with my child. Absolutely, that's a valid choice for many women. And part of, you know, this evolution for women is that there is no one-size-fits-all definition of a successful woman. All choices and all options should be equally respected. But what we're really hearing is, I've been working for 10 years or more, and I like my job, and I would like to find a way to identify a way to maintain my status in my professional environment and be a great mother. Most women are really looking to do both, at least according to our research. And the problem is that if there are flexible policies, if there are some options that would allow women some time at home with their family, the reduction in status, the reduction in pay, the reduction in participation in meaningful workplace meetings is so great that they end up choosing to stay at home with their children because they really feel that's the choice they're forced to make.
So all of these women are happy to talk to you about the problem that they're facing, but why aren't they banding together and taking up the battle again? Where's the next feminist revolution?
Well, I think that all revolutions begin with testimony. This book, part of the goal was just really to begin this dialogue. And, you know, we've had a few very large speaking engagements, and the women in the room did start to talk to each other. I think that we've all been very caught up in learning how to compete and learning how to strive. And, you know, we look at each other and we think that everyone's life is better. The single woman looks at the married woman and thinks she has it all. The married woman looks at the single woman and thinks that her life could be glamorous and wonderful. And, you know, a lot of us, you know, are also so busy. You know, we have the longest work week in history. You know, free time has fallen by 40% since 1970. People are working very, very hard, very long hours. And at the end of the day, there's not a lot of time for all of this wonderful female bonding that you see on Sex and the City and portrayed other places in the media. You know, so I think that just finding that time and really finding a common purpose is the first step. And I think, you know, the opt-out revolution, even though I didn't agree with the thesis, it's provocative. It gets people talking. And I think this is a very good climate for the presentation and introduction of some of these issues.
Did you manage to figure out or get an idea from all these interviews that you did about where marriage and family should enter the picture for working women?
Well, I think one of the most important conclusions in the book, and you know, one of the reasons that we think that this book is very important, is that it really states very loud and clear that there is no one right answer to this question you're asking. That, you know, we have evolved as women so that our lives need not look like cookie cutter versions of each other. There is no white picket fence, three children before 30. You know, married to a wonderful husband who will support you, that is not the one identity of a successful woman now. You know, we very, very deliberately in the second half of our book called The New Girls Club, which is essentially a wink to the old boys club and really, you know, encourages women to create meaningful alliances inside and outside of the workplace. When we interviewed this really wonderful group of impressive, successful women from, you know, Oxygen founder Jerry Laybourne to vice presidential candidate Geraldine Ferraro to presidential advisor Mary Matlin to CNN's Paula Zahn to financial strategist Susie Orman. What we really tried to create was a sense of new role models that are more relevant for the world we live in today. And that means, you know, a story from Vogue writer Julia Reed about her first time wedding at age 42 and why she was so thrilled that she waited so many years, canceled her wedding at 29, made this choice, and it allowed her career to evolve in ways she'd never imagined, allowed her life to take flight in such wonderful ways. That's a new role model for all of those single women out there in their 30s.
Leah Macko is the co-author of the book Midlife Crisis at 30. She lives and works in New York City. You can find out more about the films, books, and music featured on To the Best of Our Knowledge at our website. It's www.ttbook.org. Drop us a note while you're there. We always love to hear from you. Coming up, a long-distance swimmer fixes her eye on the seemingly impossible.
As I started training, it sort of got bigger and bigger, and I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to try to do the first Antarctic mile?
Coming up, I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. To Lynn Cox, swimming is a way of life, and the harder the better. At age 14, she swam to Catalina Island from mainland California. At 15, she broke the men's and women's records for swimming the English Channel. And that was just the beginning. Since then, she's gone on to conquer the treacherous Strait of Magellan and the shark-infested waters ringing the Cape of Good Hope. Then she decided to try the impossible, the icy waters of Antarctica. She writes about her career as a long-distance swimmer in the book Swimming to Antarctica. She told Steve Paulson that the waters of Antarctica present many challenges.
The currents and tides aren't mapped. They've been studying them down there for 17 years, and people still don't know which way the currents move. And usually when you do a channel swim, that's one of the basic things that you figure out ahead of time. Also, the weather there is so unstable. It can go from a very calm to 60-knot winds within 15 or 20 minutes. There's also the problem of ice. You can have glaciers snap off and become icebergs, and if you're swimming around them, it can be a bad thing. So those were some of the challenges, but also beyond that, there was the wildlife. There were orcas, killer whales, and there were also leopards seals that are 10 feet long and weigh up to 1,000 pounds, and they can be aggressive. And actually, a British researcher was killed by one about 3 months after I was down there.
So you like this kind of danger, is what you're telling me.
I like this kind of exploration. I like the idea of pushing the body beyond what's been done and sort of feeling out what human beings can do and how far that reach can be. Also, the other idea is that you're sort of jumping into this unexplored territory where people haven't been before in a bathing suit cap and goggles. And just the sensation of it is so extraordinary, to be in water that's 32 degrees and realize that it feels so viscous because it is so thick, because it is so dense. And it's just weird to have that kind of experience. But more than that, the water there is so clear. You can see as if it's like moving through sky.
Hmm. Now, to think you were going to swim in this water, were you scared?
There was a big element of fear in this whole thing because I knew that no one had done this before, and I trained for it, and I had done swims that were in water as cold as 38 degrees, but nothing like this before. So it was a huge challenge.
Now, you had actually been training for this particular swim in the Antarctic for 2 years. What did you do to get ready for this extremely cold water?
I did things I'd never done before. I sort of became a sprinter. Instead of training and going 4 or 5 hour swims, I wound up doing an hour in my folks' backyard pool, swimming head up and moving arms as fast as I could for an hour, and basically trying to simulate what I would be doing something similar to in Antarctica. The biggest thing I really needed to do was to learn how to swim more with my head up and at the same time have the power to move through the water.
Now, the reason for swimming with the head up is it's just too cold. You lose too much body heat if you have your head in the water.
That's exactly right. You lose up to 80% of your heat through your head. You know that, being in Wisconsin. And so the idea was that if I could swim head up, I would be able to prolong my ability to stay in the cold. But at some point, you know, you get tireder because you're pressing your entire body against the water. You're sort of almost swimming it upright. So in order to compensate for that, I had to do a whole lot more weight training. And I actually worked with a trainer who had been a collegiate wrestler who helped me work on building upper body strength.
Did you also just spend time in the cold, whether it's cold water or cold air, just kind of hanging out to try to get used to it?
Yes, I went to Ushuaia, Argentina, at the very tip of Argentina, and trained in the harbor there, where the water temperature was about 40 degrees. And actually, it was so cold that it would take me pretty much all day to psych up to go in for my workout. And then I'd sort of put my clothes down on the beach, and hopefully they wouldn't blow into the water. There's some days the winds were between 40 and 50 knots, and it was just hard getting in. And yet, I knew I had to do this to prepare for the swim in Antarctica.
Now, we've been talking about some of the preparation you did to get ready for this swim in the Antarctic. One thing was to try to figure out what you'd do after you got out of the water, because there was a real danger of hypothermia, and these temperatures could kill an ordinary person in not very many minutes.
Yeah, actually, I found out from a professor at the University of Edmonton that the normal response to falling into water that's below 40 degrees is that you'll start to seize up after 6 or 8 minutes. You won't be able to have the muscular impulses, the neuromuscular impulses, to make the muscles move. And so he thought this was just astonishing that I could even swim in that water. But the biggest concern I had really was for afterwards, because when you're no longer creating heat through muscle activity, you start to get cold. And then you start to bring in the cool blood from the exterior body and put into your core of your body, and you get what's called afterdrop. And so your temperature starts to plummet, and that's when you can have really big problems where your heart can go into arrhythmia or something worse. So what we did instead was to get a scarf and a polypropylene shirt and some pants. And a friend of mine sewed pockets into them. So the pockets were on either side of my neck, under my armpits, and right near the hip bones. And we put hot packs in those areas, those things that you use when you go skiing and you get cold and you want to warm up your fingers or your toes. That's what we did. So when I finished the swim, I put those clothes on, but I also had my doctor friends who basically acted like penguins and moved in really, really close to me and hugged me and gave me their body heat. And I sort of shivered for an hour and got my temperature back up to normal.
Now, it's worth pointing out that you are a medical marvel. For some reason, temperatures that would kill a lot of other people don't for you? And scientists have actually tested your body, your physiology. What have they discovered about you?
They've discovered that I am able to close down the circulation to the peripheral area, to the skin and to the fingers and toes and hands and feet really rapidly and keep it closed down. If you took an untrained person and put them in the cold, you'd have that response initially. And then at some point, the body would say, you know, we need to get oxygen out to those tissues. And so they would send, the body would start sending surges of blood out there and then bring that cooled blood back to the core. And that in turn would cool down the core, the center of the body. But my body basically says, lose the hands, lose the feet, keep the core warm and keep the brain and lungs and heart going. And it also will sort of send out a minute amount of blood to the extremities at the fingertip level and at the toe level.
Okay, so you had your practice swim. You realized you could do that. And now it was time for the real one, for the whole 1 mile touching land on Antarctica. What happened?
Well, we took the ship down to an area called Paradise Harbor, and we were looking for beaches where I could land. There aren't that many beaches in Antarctica along the peninsula. There are areas that are huge glaciers and that just sort of slide right down to the ocean, and you can't swim near those glaciers because you're afraid of the falling icebergs. So we kept looking for places where we could land, but there weren't many because the wind had shifted and the icebergs had sort of accumulated in different areas, and a lot of them were the beaches. So we searched for probably half the morning until we came to a place called Niuko Harbor, and it's this just beautiful area where the beach is maybe an 800-yard wide strip that's sort of terracotta stoned, and there are glaciers on either side of it. And we saw that the weather was fairly calm and decided that it was a good day for a swim.
So you just hopped in the water and did your mile.
That's pretty much it. I mean, there's really no time to sort of quibble or second guess or wonder. The crew had been through the test swim. They knew what they needed to do. And so I went into the cabin to sort of sit down and focus. And actually, I got some temperature measurements before and after the swim. And so we found that taking the core temperature before I even started the swim, my temperature was up to 102.2. And then when I finished the swim, it was down to 95.5. And within an hour, it was back up to normal.
Hmm. How difficult was that swim?
Really, 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 really hard. It was the most difficult thing I've ever done, mostly because I had done the test swim only a day before, and it took a huge amount out of me. And also, I had some nerve damage from that first swim, so I realized that my first line of defense of being able to tell how I was doing on the peripheral area, you know, on the skin level, was gone. And so that would mean that I'd have to even be more fine-tuned to what was going on and more aware of what was going on around me. But it was also hard because I really didn't like shivering so hard at the end of the first test swim. Your body has to work awfully hard when it's that cold to get warm again. And I think I was working as hard shivering as I had done during that first test swim. And I actually thought, you know what? I swam 0.9 miles. Maybe that should count as the Antarctic mile. This is all true. It's like, oh, no. And then I thought, you know, I've come this far, and this would be short as the goal, and I really should go for the mile. And I really wanted to swim to the continent, you know, not the subcontinent. And this was 32-degree water, and it was just that degree more. And so I think I just decided that it was time to do it when the conditions are right, and we went forward.
Now, it sounds just miserable. I mean, it's basically a survival test. Can you do it? Is there anything at all enjoyable about this?
It's not miserable, and it's not a survival test. I mean, those are elements in it, but it's also the idea that you are jumping into unknown waters, that you are swimming through water that is so clear that you can see penguins jumping in toward the end of the swim and swimming with you. You can see them porpoising through the water and see their water bubbles coming up all around you. And you are sort of in a world that nobody else has really been in this way before, or maybe even wanted to ever do it that way.
So what did it feel like at the end when you touched land? Did you have this great sense of triumph?
I had this great sense of triumph because it was as if we had done something never done, and I had a group of people around me who had shared in this idea and this dream and had extended themselves to help me do what I wanted to do. And I felt like it was an achievement that we really all shared.
Now, you've said this was your hardest swim that you've ever done, but you've done some pretty hard swims in earlier years. I mean, there was one, for instance, down in New Zealand where you, after, what, a few hours, you actually were further back from where you had started from because the waves were so big?
Actually, that's exactly right. I had been swimming between the North and South Islands of New Zealand, and there were two storms converging, and we weren't aware of it because we didn't have the weather satellite stuff that we have now. And so after 5 hours of swimming, I was further from the finish than I had started. The current had carried me around the North Island, and I was really fighting to go on.
But you did go on.
Well, I did go on because I had a school of dolphins who came in and started swimming with me, with the people in the boats. They were all around our boats and beside the paddler near me. And the water visibility was about 50 feet, and you could look down and see dolphins swimming around dolphins, and they would suddenly leap out of the water and then spin and spiral and click and squeak and chatter. And they stayed with me for about an hour. And in that time, I sort of lost the sense of, I can't do this anymore. So I kept going. And periodically throughout the next, I don't know how many hours, the swim wound up taking 12 hours and 2 minutes. But throughout the swim, the dolphins would come back in moments when I didn't feel like I could go any further. And actually, toward the end of the swim, they wound up guiding us right into an area where I could land on shore.
Hmm. And the story then of what happened throughout New Zealand, I mean, it sounds like it almost turned into a national celebration that you had done this swim.
Actually, while I was swimming and having so many difficulties, people throughout New Zealand began calling out to the ship's radio to say, you know, Lynn, we believe in you. Keep going. There were Boy Scouts from Christchurch and beekeepers from Wellington, and people all over the country, even as far as the Bay of Islands to the north, were calling and saying, keep going. And actually, the Prime Minister of New Zealand called and said, you have the country of New Zealand behind you. So it was really extraordinary. And actually, during the swim, there were a couple ships that went across Cook Straits, and they came in and raised the American flag and tooted their horns and basically showed their support. So by the time I finished the swim, pretty much all the country, you know, the land of Hillary, knew about my swim. And then the next day, church bells were rung throughout the country at noon.
I can't imagine that.
It was wonderful. It made me realize that a swim can be so much more than just an athletic venture, that it can be a way to bring people together. And through that, you know, you get so much strength. But also they share in that excitement of being able to succeed at it.
Lynn Cox is a long-distance swimmer and the author of the book Swimming to Antarctica. Steve Paulson spoke with her.
This summer I went swimming, this summer I might have drowned. But I held my breath and I kicked my feet and I moved my arms around. I moved my arms around.
Coming up, women helping women to rebuild after rape and war.
The woman in Rwanda, Beatrice, 7 of her children died on top of her in one of the churches massacre. When I met her, she had adopted 5 children. She had built a small hut for them, and she's starting an income-generating process, and she was looking at me with a smile.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Zainab Salbi is helping women around the world find the strength within themselves. Salbi's the founder of Women for Women International, a a group that helps women rebuild their lives after the horrors of war. So far, they've given out about $9 million in aid and helped women in 10 countries, including Rwanda, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Iraq. Zabi says it's easy for her to understand the women she helps today.
I'm originally from Iraq, and I grew up with the Iran-Iraq war. So in many ways, I empathize, with the whole idea of surviving a war. Not to compare my experience with anybody's experience. It's just each have their own values and their own dynamics. But the whole idea of the vulnerability of being dispossessed, of losing everything in your life, of losing loved ones in your life, is a very familiar idea for me. Not only that I go through some of it, but I lived with many people who've gone through all of these things. And so it came with my own background saying that we cannot just watch and say, oh, it's good that it's not happening to me. But we really do have responsibilities as human beings to do something as small as maybe stuffing an envelope or picking up a trash or whatever to make this world a better place. I do think that we each have an individual responsibility for that.
These days, you help women in over 20 countries, I understand. You must have met thousands of women by this time. I wonder, can you give us a sense of what these women have gone through?
Interesting, because you see similar patterns to the role of women in conflicts, from the negative pattern to the positive one as well. The challenges that women face historically and particularly in modern wars is that they are targeted as a weapon of war. In particular with rape. We started with women in Bosnia, where 20,000 women were raped in organized rape camps. Then the next war after that was Rwanda, where 450,000 women were raped over a 4-month period. And then it goes on and on and on. And the latest war is the Democratic Republic of Congo, in which the minimum that is estimated that about over 90,000 women who were raped in the last 5 years. And I recently came from there, and I think that this is the minimum estimate and not the maximum. There's a pattern of how women are viewed. Soldiers and people generally, you know, come, they kill, they pillage, and the rape of women goes with that. You know, it's almost consistent.
The horror of the size of what you're talking about is so large that the individual women almost disappear in that ugliness. But you have met the individual women, and I wonder, how do they deal with it? How does a woman whose name you know tell you her story?
Well, resilience. Over the time, I learned that we all have that resilience in us. It doesn't show itself until it is a crisis situation. So, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, recently I met a woman, her name is Nabito, and she sat with me for about an hour and a half talking about how 8 soldiers raped her in front of her children, how her boys were even actually forced to spread her legs and her hands as the soldiers were raping her, how her hands were broken 3 years ago and still is broken. She has not had the ability to fix it or to even go to the hospital. And this woman is sitting with me and talking to me about her dreams. And her dreams are so simple. She was saying that all what I want is to be able to feel like a human being again. To be able to feel like a woman again. And that entailed having her job. You know, she was a farmer, so she had some animals and some small land that she farmed. So being a human being again for her was to be able not to beg, to be able to earn a living. She wanted to be able to buy her own clothes and not have people just give her her clothes. She wanted to be able to have a decent slipper as opposed to the ones that she had made herself from trash, basically. But the resilience for her to stand up, to sit down, to talk about it, to keep on going. Another woman in Rwanda, Beatrice, 7 of her children died on top of her in one of the churches massacre. When I met her, she had adopted 5 children. She had built a small hut for them, and she's starting an income generating process. And she was looking at me with a smile, thanking me for listening to her and thanking the people who made it possible for me to even go to Rwanda to listen to her. So you hear these women's stories and the resilience that they are there, what they've been through, and that we're not giving up, that we're going to keep on going and we cannot afford to give up.
But it's not just listening to their stories that you do. Women for Women actually provide some help so that the woman in the Congo, for instance, can get a loan from you to help rebuild her farm, for instance?
Well, We have a three-prong approach, actually. And the organization tried to help them move from a stage of victimhood to survivors to active citizens. And so with the humanitarian aid stage, we have a sponsorship program in which we connect women with women in the countries that we work with. Each sponsor sent the matched sister $25 a month, along with a letter to start communication link between the two women. Because a lot of times, the common thing also is the feeling of abandonment. So to get a letter from someone saying, I care, you exist, I'm going to be here for you, I'm not going to leave you, I'm going to help you, you know, stand on your feet. Immediately, as we sponsor them, we immediately start getting into tangible vocational skills training in which we can help them get employable skills. So it's a very intensive program that we meet with the women every single week for a whole year in which she's getting money, she's getting letters, she's getting two kinds of trainings, women's rights training as well as business skills trainings. And at the end of the year, she graduates with income generating opportunities. In our beliefs that the question to building peace in particularly countries in post-conflict actually has a lot to do with providing options and choices, tangible choices for women. We can't talk about democracy in a vacuum. We can't talk about wanting to help in a vacuum if we do not give them tangible opportunities to stand on their feet and to be financially as well as politically and socially independent.
These are success stories, and they're very nice to hear. Do they help you compensate for all of the horror stories that you have to listen to as well?
It makes it worth it. You know, at the it's a very hard thing to go and hear to these horror stories. But then, you know, you hear the success ones as well, and it just makes it worth it. My favorite is a woman named Zainaba in Bosnia. And she's a survivor of the Srebrenica massacre, one of the worst massacres in Bosnia. Her husband was in a prison camp for 2 years. By the time he was released, he was severely handicapped. When we first met her was back in 97. She had nothing whatsoever. I still have chills all over when I think about her. Nothing. She had cardboards where she slept with her children. Got into our program, got, you know, all the services that I just mentioned, got the loans, bought a cow. Long story short, I met her about 2 years ago, actually, and I still follow up her story. She had bought a house. She owns 7 cows, which is a big deal, actually. I don't know how many chicken, some sheep, all of these things. When I met with her, she was crying as well as smiling and just saying, everything is okay now. So you see that smile, it's like, it's worth it. You know, you had to hear the horror, but it's worth it because to see that the resilience in human spirits, to see the courage they have, to say, I'm not giving up. I am going to continue going. And that's how I fight the enemy, by surviving, by keep on going, by building my country, by building my life.
Your home and where you started this project is Iraq, which has changed in the years since you first began Women for Women. What is life like for women in Iraq now?
Iraq is one of the last countries that we opened the office in because I couldn't start in Iraq. I started in Bosnia because Iraq was under Saddam Hussein's rule and no one could operate independently there. And I always felt it was unethical to promise people to deliver the services to the women if I cannot guarantee it. So we never did until after the war. And the first time I went to Iraq actually was 3 weeks after the war, about last May. Fascinating, actually, to be back home. Women have gone a lot through Iraq's, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, rather. And a lot of times we don't have too much knowledge about it. We know about, Saddam did have a massive campaign to combat illiteracy, for example, and did have employment opportunities for women in both the formal as well as informal sector. There was about 30% representation of women in the Iraqi parliament. It was almost that, you know, the Ba'athist Party knew what was proper to say when it comes to women's issues. There was an Iraqi women union, all of these things. The cover, I always say, was good, looked good, and that's what people still know about Iraqi women, and they don't know anything else. When I went back, there was institutionalized poverty, marginalized areas where women actually were majority of single heads of household. There was a lot of consequences on the political imprisonment and tortures of men, on the women because they had to take care on. There was institutionalized violence, for example, carried on by the Ba'athist Party. Rape and sexual torture was often used as a way of political torture against the man or the woman herself. So, for example, to torture a man or a political opponent, often they raped his sister or his daughter or his mother and videotaped that and they used that as part of his interrogation. women were actually sent back and forth. When there was a war with Iran, women took the leadership in terms of carrying on economic opportunities in Iraq. The minute the war was ended, women were sent back home. So there is mixed messaging constantly between what is the cover, the gift wrap, as I call it, and what was the content and the substance of it. And the substance was very much embedded in chauvinism and in misogyny. After the war, it wasn't necessarily that much easier. On the other hand, on the flip side, there's also a lot more opportunities for women. This is the time for Iraqi women to establish their new role in the new Iraq, to be part of the constitution, to be part of the new government, to have a voice in how they want to shape their role. And it's not imposed on them, but it's their own ownership. So there's the challenges that we really do need to acknowledge, and we need to acknowledge in a historical perspective what these women have been through. And there are lots of opportunities that are out there, and it's a matter of grabbing it, and it's a matter of providing it to as many women as possible.
Does it present particular problems for an organization like yours, Women for Women, to move into a country like Iraq where Islamic fundamentalism is beginning to take hold again? It's hard to understand, for instance, how women who have to cover themselves can at the same time begin to take power.
Not at all. You know what? I call it as our political burqa in here. You know, the burqa, you know, when I go to Afghanistan, I try it on just to see out of curiosity. And it's a horse blinder. You know, you only see what's straight in front of you. What we really need to do is lift it, us in the West, in here, lift it and see the complexity, as I said, of women's lives. As I was growing up, for example, my high school friend had to fight for months with her family to allow her to cover her hair. It's her family who were against it, and she was crying and begging and all of these things until, you know, they gave up and allowed her to cover her hair. A lot of times the covering of the actual hair, that whether it's the chador or whether it's the burqa or whether it's just a simple headscarf, is actually irrelevant a lot of times. What's relevant is the choices. Are the women making the choices to cover or uncover? Every time I go to Afghanistan or even to Iraq, and it's like, well, how about you're still wearing the burqa? And it's like, who cares? We want jobs. We want real choices. Who cares about what we're wearing?
Zainab Salbi is the founder and president of Women for Women International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Tim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Doug Gordon, with engineering help from Marv Nunn. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Tough Women, number 620A. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.